Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring a really fundamental question. It's something that impacts pretty much every person listening, I think, no matter what your job title is. Mm. How do we live a creative, vibrant life without being just completely paralyzed by fear?
Mm-hmm. We're doing a deep dive into Elizabeth Gilbert's pretty radical guide, Big Magic, Creative yeah. Living Beyond Fear. And this book, it's just so much more than, you know, a guide for professional artists or writers. It really feels like a complete spiritual and practical reset button for anyone who feels a bit stuck.
Right.
Gilbert really goes head to head with that old and honestly damaging myth that creativity has to be tied to suffering or agony.
The tortured arcs trope. Exactly that. Her proposal is actually kind of revolutionary. Creativity is this abundant, generous force. And our job, it's simply to show up and, well, partner with it. So this deep dive is sort of a shortcut to understanding that liberating alternative, getting away from creative struggle.
That's the hope. It offers a different path.
Okay, so to get why this book lands with such authority, we kind of have to look at the author herself, Elizabeth Gilbert, born 1969, American writer. But her perspective, it feels like it was really forged in the blinding spotlight of just unprecedented success.
Yeah, we're talking, of course, about her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. I mean, that book wasn't just a bestseller.
No kidding.
It became a global cultural phenomenon. Sold, what, well over 12 million copies. It made her an absolute icon.
And that spectacular success, that's actually key to understanding Big Magic, isn't it? It put her in the perfect position, maybe a terrifying position, to explore that really complex relationship between creativity, fear, and expectation.
Mm-hmm, exactly. How do you keep creating when, like, the entire world is watching, waiting for you to maybe fail, or maybe even worse, fail after you've already been so incredibly successful?
Yeah, that pressure must have been immense.
Absolutely. So she had to figure out how to keep showing up at the page, you know, not just for the public, but really for herself. And her deep knowledge, it doesn't just stem from memoirs.
Right. She's got range.
Totally. She's written serious, very well-researched fiction, like The Signature of All Things. And she spent years doing really disciplined journalism, too, for places like Esquire. So her wisdom feels very practical, very tested. It comes from living it across all the different stages of a creative career.
Which makes the advice feel so, I don't know, resilient, grounded.
Spot on. Grounded is a great word for it.
Okay, let's dive into the core premise of Big Magic, then. Gilbert's main aim, it seems, is to liberate us from those limiting beliefs, that inner critic voice that keeps us feeling small and scared.
Mm-hmm. And the central, most radical idea she puts forward is this. Creativity isn't something that just belongs to us inside our heads. It's actually an independent force out there looking to collaborate with us. And that reframing, it's such a powerful tool against perfectionism, isn't it?
Oh, so.
Well, if you believe that all the brilliance has to spring, like, entirely from your individual genius, your effort alone, the pressure just becomes suffocating.
Right. Impossible.
But if you start to see yourself as more of a collaborator with this outside force, you immediately ease some of that burden. It's not all on you.
So the audience for this book, it's not just people who want to paint pictures or write novels.
Definitely not.
It's really for anyone who feels that little internal nudge, right? Like maybe starting a complicated DIY project at home or learning a really difficult new skill, or maybe finally launching that side hustle they've been dreaming about. It's about being more alive.
It is. Absolutely. The book really tries to guide you away from the heavy weight of the individual ego and more towards becoming this curious partner with, you know, the mysterious forces of inspiration.
And the measure of success changes too, then. It's not about external validation like fame or money.
Exactly. Become simply living with greater curiosity, more aliveness, more engagement. The process itself becomes the reward. It almost doesn't matter if anyone else ever sees or validates the outcome. Okay, that brings us nicely to some of the most surprising concepts she gets into. Starting with the biggest hurdle for most of us, fear. Ah, yes, fear.
She's so realistic about it, which I appreciate. She basically says fear is a natural, permanent part of the creative process. You can't just wait for it to disappear before you start.
All right, it's always going to be there.
So what's the strategy then? How do you move forward if fear is always tagging along?
Well, she gives us that incredibly powerful metaphor. It's probably the most famous part of the book. Fear is like a backseat passenger on your creative road trip. It's allowed to be there in the car because, hey, it's part of being human. But, and this is the crucial bit, it is never under any circumstances allowed to drive
mm-hmm.
or navigate or touch the radio
yeah.
or make any decisions.
Huh. I like that. Keep it in the back.
Exactly. So courage, in her definition, isn't the absence of fear. It's simply choosing to proceed with the journey despite that constant noise and worry piping up from the back seat.
That feels so much more achievable because we often tell ourselves, oh, I can't start this until I feel totally fearless.
Which never happens.
And she's saying, nope, fear's riding shotgun, or maybe in the back, just drive anyway. Precisely, just drive anyway. And that kind of leads us into the concept that always seems to generate the most buzz, the most discussion, enchantment. This is her almost mystical theory about where ideas actually come from. Right? This is where she takes that collaboration idea and pushes it maybe into supernatural territory, proposing that ideas exist as these independent, energetic life forms, swirling around us, looking for a human partner.
It sounds very romantic, doesn't it? Maybe a bit woo-woo for some.
Mm-hmm. A little, yeah.
But it serves a really practical purpose psychologically. The idea is if you show curiosity and readiness, an idea might notice you, might visit you. But, and here's the catch, if you delay or ignore it, or maybe treat it with too much agonizing reverence.
Like it's too precious to touch.
Exactly. It'll eventually get bored or impatient and just move on. It'll abandon you and find someone else who's more willing to play.
Okay, but hold on. How are we supposed to square this idea, you know, ideas as independent life forms with, say, the science of how our brains work? Cognitive psychology, is she saying this is literally true, or is it more of a helpful creative metaphor? That's a really critical question. And honestly, Gilbert doesn't force you to take it literally. Whether you see it as a literal truth or just a useful metaphor, the psychological result is the same. It lifts that heavy, heavy mantle of genius off the individual creator's shoulders. Okay.
She uses that fantastic Ann Patchett case study to illustrate it. Remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Gilbert had this very specific idea for a novel set deep in the Amazon rainforest. She held on to it for a while, but ultimately she abandoned it, didn't write it.
Right.
Years later, she meets the novelist Ann Patchett and realizes Patchett has just written this incredible novel, State of Wonder, with an astonishingly similar, very specific premise set in the Amazon.
Wow. So the idea in Gilbert's framework basically moved on. It left Gilbert's maybe list and went over to Patchett's yes list.
That's the interpretation. It completely shifts the narrative from, oh, I failed to write that book, to something more like, the idea simply needed a different host at that particular time. It wasn't personal failure.
That really does shift the burden. Okay, so you're responsible for the work ethic, the showing up part.
Yes.
But you're not solely responsible for the existence of the inspiration itself. That feels lighter.
It does. And that brings us quite neatly from that lightning bolt of inspiration, the enchantment part, to the daily reality, the grind, persistence.
Ah, yes. Gilbert the Pragmatist returns here. She introduces that very memorable concept she calls the shit sandwich.
Yes. It sounds pretty gross, but honestly, it's such a useful clarifying tool.
What exactly does she mean by it?
It's basically the recognition that every single pursuit, no matter how wonderful or glorious it seems from the outside, comes with its own set of unpleasant aspects.
Yeah.
Its own particular brand of shit.
Okay.
Every job, every creative endeavor, writing, painting, starting a business, playing music, it all comes with rejection or tedious admin work or maybe moments of physical discomfort or pain.
Right. The parts nobody puts on Instagram.
Exactly. Fulfillment, Gilbert argues, requires you to identify and then consciously choose the specific shit sandwich you are willing to eat day in and day out in pursuit of the thing you love.
So, like, for a musician, the shit sandwich might be lugging heavy gear through the rain at 2 a.m. after a gig.
Mm.
Or for a writer, it's maybe the 100th round of soul-destroying copy edits when you absolutely hate every sentence you've ever written.
You got it. It's the necessary, unavoidable cost of getting to do the joyful part. It's the part you have to learn to accept, not just tolerate with gritted teeth.
And her practical advice around this is?
Show up.
Mm.
Consistently. Whether you feel inspired or not. She champions what she calls stubborn gladness-like, choosing joy even when it's tough. And she gives us that ultimate mantra, especially powerful for anyone battling procrastination or paralysis.
Let me guess, done is better than good.
That's the one. Just get it done. It doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
That mantra connects so directly to the final big concept we should cover, permission and trust. Because if you're always waiting for permission, always waiting to be made good enough by some external force, you'll never actually get anything done, let alone good. She argues this so fiercely. You do not need official credentials. You don't need an MFA. You don't need glowing reviews from critics. You don't need anyone's permission slip.
So what do you need?
Only internal authorization matters. You have the inherent right to create simply because you exist and you feel curious about something. That's it. And critically, you then have to trust the mysterious process itself, and this is the hard part, let go of trying to control the outcome.
And she gives really practical advice here too, doesn't she? About maybe not quitting your day job, which feels almost counterintuitive to that whole follow your passion at all costs narrative we hear so often. It really does cut against the grain. But her reasoning is solid. Keeping a day job removes the intense financial pressure from your creative work.
Ah, okay.
It ensures your creative pursuits can remain a love affair, something you do purely for the intrinsic satisfaction, for the joy of it. If you suddenly depend on that painting or that novel or that Etsy shop to pay your rent, it instantly transforms into a marriage burdened by heavy financial expectations.
And that pressure often kills the very spontaneity and joy needed to do good creative work in the first place. Precisely. It protects the magic, in a way. Okay, let's try and synthesize some of these core mindsets she champions, because they feel really profoundly liberating when you take them on board. Theme one seems to be creativity as a birthright, not some elite privilege.
Yeah, that's huge. It truly democratizes the whole idea of creativity. Gilbert actively challenges those cultural stories that try to reserve creative expression only for a chosen few, usually depicted as suffering.
Right.
She says, no, every single human being is entitled to explore their own creative nature, whether that means taking a casual ceramics class on a Tuesday night or, you know, composing symphonies. It takes the immense pressure and seriousness out of it in a really helpful way. And theme two, which I think sometimes gets overlooked but is so practical, the power of curiosity over passion. Oh, this is such a great point. Passion can feel so high stakes, so dramatic and intimidating. And if you don't feel this blinding, life-altering passion for something, it's easy to feel like, well, maybe you're just not a creative person. Like you're failing somehow.
Yeah, the pressure to find your passion. Exactly. But curiosity, Gilbert suggests, is the quieter, more reliable guide. It just sort of whispers, hey, what's that interesting thing over there? Following those small trails of curiosity, the things that just pique your interest, even a little bit, is a much less intimidating and, frankly, far more sustainable path than sitting around waiting for some monumental passion to strike you like lightning.
It makes creativity feel more accessible on a daily basis. It really does.
Yeah.
And finally, theme three, which we touched on earlier when talking about persistence. Dismantling the myth of creative suffering. Getting rid of the tortured artist idea for good.
Yes. Agony is not a prerequisite for making great art. In fact, Gilbert argues quite convincingly that deep-seated emotional pain and suffering often actively inhibit creative output in the long run.
Interesting.
She completely throws out that romanticized notion of the tortured artist. She says finding joy, finding playfulness, resilience, adopting what she calls the trickster mindset, is far, far better for lifelong creative fulfillment than constantly playing the solemn, suffering martyr.
The book is just packed with these memorable lines, isn't it? Little phrases that instantly click and reframe how you look at your own creative blocks or fears.
Absolutely. It's very quotable.
Let's share maybe a few of the most impactful ones. Okay. Well, the one that just cuts straight through all the noise about needing external validation has to be, you do not need anybody's permission to live a creative life. Boom. Simple as that. That's the whole self-authorization argument right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the one that so perfectly skewers that ultimate creative killer, perfectionism. Perfectionism is just fear and fancy shoes and a mink coat, pretending to be elegant when actually it's just terrified. I love that imagery. It makes perfectionism seem suddenly less noble and more, well, kind of flimsy and comical. Takes away its power. It really does. And maybe one more, the one that really encapsulates that spiritual collaborative dimension she talks about throughout the whole book. The universe buries strange jewels deep within us all and then stands back to see if we can find them. Oh, that's beautiful. It transforms the whole creative life from feeling like a grueling job into more of a treasure hunt, a quest for self-discovery.
Yeah, collaboration with the universe, in a way. So thinking practically, how can listeners apply some of this right away? Let's consider application one, managing creative blocks.
Well, using her framework, if you view ideas as these external partners, you immediately depersonalize the block, right? It's no longer about you being a failure or lacking talent.
Right. It's just a natural lull in the partnership.
Yeah.
Maybe the idea is busy elsewhere for a bit. It's just a rhythm.
Exactly. So instead of sitting there beating yourself up or waiting for a lightning bolt, You just take one small, curiosity-driven step towards the work. Anything.
Just show up in some small way. And application two is really about integrating creativity sustainably into your actual life. Think about that example Gilbert gives of her friend Susan.
Ah, the figure skater.
Yes, who took up competitive figure skating in her 40s, not because she planned to go to the Olympics or become a professional coach.
Right, she did it purely for the joy and the challenge of the process itself.
Precisely. It's a perfect illustration that creative fulfillment is found in the engagement, in the showing up, without necessarily requiring huge financial risks or blowing up your entire life. You can absolutely be creative and have stability.
That feels like such a powerful and, frankly, relieving conclusion for so many people.
Yeah.
If I had to pick one final takeaway that really struck me, it's the profound sense of liberation, especially from ego, that comes from adopting her view of ideas as external forces.
Mm-hmm.
It somehow makes the creative work feel less like this torturous, self-important burden you have to carry alone, and more like a joyful, maybe even humble act of service you perform for the idea.
That's beautifully put. And I think that really is the final synthesis of the book, isn't it? The most valuable lesson Gilbert offers is that complete reframing of creativity, moving it away from being seen as this grueling, high-stakes struggle that demands suffering.
Yeah.
And towards being a sustainable, often joyful collaboration, one that's based simply on consistently choosing curiosity and courage over fear. And that shift, that really is big magic. And the best part is, it's accessible to absolutely everyone listening.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.